You're listening to C2Y Podcast. We bring you discussions on child and youth care that feature conversations with young people, parents, and professionals about the youth social service system. Introducing your host, Wolfgang Vachon.
Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Is it oppression when an 8-year-old boy is made to stay past regular school hours because he called the teacher a name after failing a spelling test? Is it oppression if that child is not assessed for a learning disability after failing every spelling test since starting grade 3? Is it oppression when a child is removed from the home because her parents are unable to care for her? Is it oppression when that same young girl grows up in care and after moving through 6 placements and 6 schools, she drops out before she completes grade 12? Is it oppression if a young trans person is kicked out of their house for their gender identity? Is it oppression if they are told they have to live as the gender assigned at birth when they go to jail and they can't go into the range of the gender they identify as? The new Child and Youth Care Vocational Standards for all colleges in Ontario requires graduates to, quote, demonstrate the ability to advocate for the rights of children, youth, and their families, and maintain an anti-oppression perspective and cultural competence in diverse cultural contexts. End of the quote. Today we're talking with two guests about oppression and anti-oppression in child and youth care. Rebecca Ward teaches in the Faculty of Child and Youth Work at Confederation College in Thunder Bay, Ontario, and Wanda MacArthur is the Manager of Children's Services at the Children's Aid Society, also of the District of Thunder Bay. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start with some definitional language here. Wanda, can you walk us through what oppression is?
There's a number of different ways that you can define oppression. Simply put, it's acting unjustly, treating groups of people unjustly when they are defined by a certain way. So for example, we see that there's a dominant group within society, and it's that group that generally creates the norms and the rules of how we're meant to live and what is meant to be acceptable. So we have groups of people who then, by virtue of something that they may be born into, are treated less than. It's about difference, really. It comes down to the way in which we respond to differences. So when I say that, we look at culture, a white dominant culture, and what are the differences outside of that? So we see racial differences and the way in which people are oppressed based on, for example, race. Is do we exploit that difference or do we deny that difference?
So how might we exploit that difference or deny that difference in a way that would be oppressive?
We deny opportunity based on race. We can deny opportunity based on sexual orientation, gender identity. We can exploit people based on age. There's a certain age demographic that would be seen as more dominant and more acceptable than persons outside of that age. You see it in the economics of the world. Class as one of the dominant groups, your middle and upper class, definitely exploit those people who don't fit in within that class assignment. The discussions that you see most recently about minimum wage is a really good example of the ways in which we exploit people based on their class.
In that we are comfortable paying people lower wages. I recently heard that in the fast food industry in the U.S., and I assume it's similar here, but there is over a 12,000% difference between the lowest paid employees at McDonald's, Burger King, Taco Bell, and the highest paid employees. And would that be an example of that exploitation?
Absolutely, it's an example of it. And the way that it gets sort of validated and why oppression is so difficult sometimes to overcome is because we live in a world that has some myths about the dominant group and about society as a whole. And a really good example of that as it relates to class and the oppression of persons who are in the working class or are people living in poverty is this notion of that we live in a world of scarcity. And so you have to fight for what you can have. And if you're not fighting hard enough, you're not trying hard enough. And so we're able to blame people and we're able to reinforce that oppression because we can say they're not trying hard enough.
And so when we see groups, let's talk, for example, of First Nations people, and we look at rates of poverty, we look at rates of infant mortality, we look at rates of employment, we look at rates of high school dropout, and in First Nations communities in Canada and elsewhere around the world for that matter, those rates are much, much higher. When we then say, well, that culture is lazy, that culture is unmotivated, that culture is this, that culture is that, that would be a form of what you're speaking of?
Absolutely. And oppression isn't just, it's not just at the personal level. I, as an individual, am not just an oppressor. It's so intertwined with all of the various facets of prejudice and discrimination. So when we're looking at oppression, we have to look at it not just at that personal level where that one person can have racist opinions about another person and we can be dismissive of him or her. We also have to look at it as at a cultural level. And by culture, I mean just it's so pervasive around us. It's so there's all kinds of norms that have been laid out to us by the dominant group in society that we're almost born into oppression. We're born into it. We may not be born oppressive people, but we are, or we may not be born racist, but we're born into a racist world. So there's that cultural component that reinforces and validates a personal level of oppression. But it's all those personal levels of oppression that also reinforce the norms. Somebody is setting out the standards, and it's the dominant group. And that's where you come back to difference. And that's where you can deny a person's difference. That's where you can exploit a person's difference.
So if me as an individual, I think a negative thought or a negative perception, or I make a racist comment towards First Nations people or Aboriginal people in Canada, that wouldn't necessarily be oppression, although it might be a result of growing up in an oppressive society, but that would be an individually racist comment, is what I'm hearing you say. Whereas if the government removes policing from First Nations communities and says, you are responsible for all your policing and we don't have the funds to train, you know, people to adequately police your community and we're not going to support you and it's up to you and if you can't do it, that's your own fault, that would be a form of oppression.
Right. So that's the sort of the third strata of oppression would be that structural level.
Okay.
And so all of these work together, the personal, the cultural, and the structural levels of oppression to just validate and support each component of it. So structurally, we're talking about an economic system worldwide, but here in Canada, that suggests that you have to work hard and everybody has equal opportunity. Therefore, if you are living, for example, in poverty, if you're a First Nations person and the reserve that you live on is in third world condition, there's something inherently wrong, not with the system,
but with you or your community.
Sure.
Rebecca, how does oppression impact the young people that we work with?
That's a great question. And I've been sort of reflecting on the questions you posed as a starting point earlier in the week and began to think of my own experiences with this concept and where it originated and how it became foundational, really, to the work I was doing directly as a childcare worker. And then as a manager and now as a faculty person, it's really embedded in all of every course that I teach. At some point, I realized that the children and families that we were serving did not have equal opportunity to be self-actualized human beings. And that very experience was resulting in behavioral issues in the kids that we are working with, that was further reinforcing those oppressive circumstances.
So could you break that down a little bit? So how did the unequal opportunities translate into behaviors that you were seeing?
Okay. When I did my graduate degree, I really tried to better understand the needs of really aggressive children. And I recognized, the reason I focused on that is I realized pretty early on that our system was not working in terms of helping these children. And I began to see very clearly that these children were kids coming, by the time they arrived on our doorstep, had a history or a lifetime of having their basic needs unmet. And the behavioral issues they were demonstrating became behavioral problems that kept them further removed from the actual resources they needed.
So the more they acted out, the less access they were getting, acting out, I'm putting that in quotation marks, of course, acting out, the less access to supportive, loving people they were receiving?
Yes, and not just at the personal level, but also, as Wanda was referring to earlier, at the systemic or the structural level, because not only were individual childcare workers struggling to see beyond the behavioral presentation to engage in a meaningful way with these children, the system set out to support them actually were designed with very oppressive structures to them.
And how so? So we as social service providers want to help. How is the structure oppressive?
So kids, let's say, that are in a residential facility, in a children's mental health facility, for aggressive difficulties. That's why they're there. They have mental health issues that are resulting in aggressive difficulties, which really is about internalized oppression. But we'll talk about that in a minute, I guess. But so, you know, they come to our doorstep with these issues, and our inability to reach them suggests that they actually they're not well served by this system. So we need to move them along. So instead of the system spending time and energy sorting out what is really happening for these children and shifting our practice so that we're better able to meet their needs, we actually reject them and move them along.
And move them along
into another treatment center.
Okay.
And sometimes that results in kids moving 10, 12, 16 hours away from their communities. Mm.
So that raises a question for me, and maybe I'll put this back to you, Wanda, because you work in the child welfare system. You're a manager at CAS in Thunder Bay. Many would perceive you as, you know, the great oppressor in child and youth care system. Is our work inherently oppressive?
I'll speak personally. I do believe that it is. And I'm not just speaking about child welfare, mm-hmm. although, I mean, we know through our history that we are an incredibly powerful and oppressive structure. But child and youth work, I think that as the helping profession, we are inherently oppressive. I think there's movement away from that, but there is a power differential that cannot be denied. And when we talk about oppression and we talk about it being about difference in the way that we react and respond to difference, we have to acknowledge power as being one of the critical components of the way in which we do that. And so we can walk into a young person's life and we can believe that we are going to treat them fairly and with equity, and we do it with, for all the right reasons. There's no malevolence behind it. That power, if it goes unacknowledged, creates oppression.
So how do we address that then? Because, you know, I didn't come into this field to be oppressive. I think I'm doing the right thing. I think I'm supporting. There's this young child who's, being abused, being neglected, being hurt. And so I want to support this young child. You know, never along the way did I go to school to become oppressive. How do I not be oppressive as a child and youth care practitioner? And I'd like to take it from your perspective, but I'd also like Rebecca to speak to this, particularly from the position of as an educator, how we teach people to not be oppressive.
I think the field is certainly looking at and acknowledging the real need for anti-oppression and having an anti-oppressive practice when you're in the field, but certainly from an educational perspective, embedding anti-oppressive principles throughout curriculum. If you operate from an anti-oppressive framework, you acknowledge your power. You can't take that power away. And so a couple things that are really, really important is that critical consciousness that comes with understanding oppression and your position in oppression. What is your privilege? Where are you privileged in the world? Where are you both the oppressor? And then where have you been oppressed in your life? What's your social location in the world? It's an understanding of that and having a really fundamental understanding about that personal, cultural, and structural levels of oppression as well. But really it's about, when we talk about child and youth work, we talk a lot about the importance for self-awareness. That's that critical consciousness. I think what has been missed perhaps in the past and what we're now catching on to is that we have to examine our power and our privilege and our social location in relation to the service users that we're coming in contact with.
And that's a great segue into Rebecca. So how do you teach that? How do you teach people to have a critical perspective, acknowledge their power, identify their social location, and look at their own history of both oppression and oppressive practices?
I got lots of thoughts on this, so hopefully
good.
You know, the whole aspect of self in child and youth care, it is our cornerstone. It's what separates us from all other helping disciplines, really, in terms of the priority we give it, the energy and effort we put into helping one another understand who we are in relationship, right? And understanding our position of power in relationship, I think, is just a natural component to that we need to ensure we understand in order to be helpful in relationship. I don't think this is about creating an individual course that's going to teach people how to do this. It has to be a part of everything we are teaching in terms of, you know, if we're teaching about, for example, child development, you know, are we really helping the students that we're working with to become child and youth care professionals understand what their own experience in child development looked like in terms of oppression, being both afforded opportunity and not, and how that impacted your development, and then how that impacts your lens in terms of what you see in children's development, and then, of course, looking at things like our recording. How does that then influence the narrative we start to attach to who children are and what we start to write down, which then becomes their identity? And then, you know, if you're looking really at self, are we teaching students to uncover their experiences of oppression and being oppressive in ways that will help them do that with children that are helpful? The whole notion of congruence, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm hearing is that shift from the self-awareness to going into practice, which leads into anti-oppression. And maybe we could start with a bit of a definition of what anti-oppression is and then what it could look like. So if we accept, and I'm sure not all the listeners will accept this, but if we accept that our practice is inherently oppressive, how do we then operate from an anti-oppression perspective?
Anti-oppression really, I mean, simply put, and I won't give it in any kind of clear definition, is really just about our desire, our want to recognize oppression in all its forms and to make a commitment to stand up to that oppression. It's both an outcome and a process. in that we want to always operate from a position of recognizing the injustice and fighting that injustice, but also what the anti-oppressive sort of model would suggest is that you're constantly on a journey. And so you're constantly doing what Rebecca has suggested in terms of that exploration, that self-exploration about how you yourself have been impacted by oppression and how you, in fact, continue to facilitate oppression in so much as where you are in your social location. What is your power? What is your privilege? And it's really that recognition and recognizing that you are committed to exposing that and fighting that throughout your practice.
And can I just add to that?
Please, please, please do.
Yeah, the other aspect to that I think is that we, from an anti-oppressive practice, are also acknowledging the impact of oppression on the children and families that we're working with. I mean, that's why we're committed to the things that Wanda is talking about, because we recognize the impact of oppression is very, very detrimental to the lives of children and families. It is the reason that we become involved.
The oppression creates the structures that are causing problems in many people's lives. So I want to try to find ways to bring something a bit more concrete into this. So, you know, let's go back to some of those little vignettes. And if you have a more appropriate vignette, by all means, please, or a story, by all means, please discuss it. You know, the young person swears at their teacher and, you know, gets a detention or gets sent to the principal's office. If we're the CYW or CYC practitioner in the school and we notice that this particular child and teacher seem to constantly have difficulties, how do we advocate? If we work in corrections, as more and more child and youth workers are, how do we advocate for the trans person when there's a very, very clear structure that says, you must live here? How do we support that young girl when we apprehend her from her home? What does that look like in practice?
Okay, I'll take just one. For example, the trans youth.
Yes.
I think that's one of the last bastions of prejudice and discrimination that people can be a little more overt about. Right? In terms of a world of political correctness, and you hear that term thrown around a lot, it doesn't mean that oppression and discrimination are still not very pervasive. They certainly are, but I think where we can blame, we can still do victim blaming in some ways are with our persons who live in poverty. Mm-hmm. And some of the LGBTQ community is still, it can still be targeted, the trans community specifically, because their rights have only just started to be entrenched. It's really about that understanding of what their rights are. The Ontario Human Rights Code protects them. And I would believe that as a child and youth worker in my practice, working in a setting like that, and I can tell you a relatively similar story to this, I would want to advocate on that person's behalf based on their gender identity. They would be ill-placed if their gender identity was contrary to what that custody facility was. If they identify as female, then they need to be living in the female population, and there's an incredible amount of education that has to go along with that. Their gender identity has to be protected equally to that of anyone who they're going to be sharing space with. And I think that's always been the issue when you think about LGBTQ youth being placed in group settings, is who are you trying to protect and for what reasons? And it comes back to some of those norms and those stereotypes of certain populations, marginalized populations, and we have done an injustice in that we've not protected the right person for the right reasons.
I'm resonating with what you're saying in that I've heard many times it's going to cause discomfort for the other residents, the other inmates, the other people in the community. And there seems to be a denial of the impact on the individual who is saying, well, you're going to cause the rest of the people a discomfort.
Right. Or you're a risk to that person based on who you are, what your gender identity is, or what your sexual orientation is, that somehow there's an inherent risk attached to that. And I think we've operated from that sometimes, and we've done it in ways that aren't meant to be harmful, but I mean, that the fallout, of course, is that it is harmful. We think we're protecting that individual, saying, well, we don't want you to be persecuted for this, and we don't want you to be, you know, accused of something that you're not perhaps doing. And all we do is just continue to perpetuate their marginalization. We just keep them on the fringes. And I think that we have to educate ourselves about these differences. We have to educate ourselves about the groups who are experiencing these prejudices, whether it's based on race or your sexual orientation or your gender identity, age, ability, all of that. We really have to educate ourselves, and we have to stand up to what is considered the dominant group.
I would like to pick up on that idea of standing up. And Rebecca, we are service providers, and our relationships are time limited. And ultimately, we want to leave that professional relationship with that young person with skills and capacities to thrive in life. And I know the two of you present on oppression and anti-oppression, which of course is why we're having this conversation today. But one of your goals, one of your intentions in your work is about supporting the individual to face oppression and challenge oppression. So what is our role in being an ally or advocating with the young person when it comes to oppression?
Great question. I think what's really important in terms of how we tackle this issue and how we move forward and how we stay committed to anti-oppression and social justice and is that we are, you know, using some of Paulo Freire's thinking, and that we get to a place of understanding that we are only going to make significant movement until we are helping people liberate themselves, essentially. And so using a really strong children's, a rights-based approach to practice, to me, means making sure that my intervention with that child, regardless of the issue, involves at a central level my helping them understand what their rights are and how to advocate for themselves, so that eventually I get to a place where my job is merely to create space for them to do that piece of work. And I mean, I try to do that in terms of what I'm teaching students, and congruence is a big thing for me. The other thing I try to do to sort of help them get there is teach those skills to them, so that by the end of 3 years, my job is merely just to create the space. And they are well aware of what their rights are as a student, and they are advocating for what they need and want. And that's what I'd love to see them do in their relationships with children.
Yeah, this raises a tension I've often felt when I think about working from an anti-oppression perspective. This, you know, Freire talks about, and excuse my Portuguese, it's atrocious, conscientization, the idea of bringing awareness, bringing a political consciousness to those he worked with, and read the word to read the world, as he said. You know, I've met many young people of color who say, yeah, I don't experience racism. It's not an issue for me. I've met, you know, particularly growing up in Toronto and working in Toronto, I've met many young LGBTQ identified people who say, well, I don't deal with homophobia now, right? I mean, it's easy. And part of me is uncomfortable to say, well, yes, you do experience racism. Yes, you do experience sexism. Yes, you do experience homophobia or transphobia. Is it our job to say, yes, you are oppressed?
That's another really good question. I think, I don't know, can I jump?
Yeah.
I'm thinking around this idea of awareness and consciousness raising, really, mm-hmm. and using that paradigm that people are going to come to their own ways of seeing this concept in their life. And I don't really think it's my job ever to determine someone else's experience. But I can attempt to raise consciousness that this experience exists mm-hmm. and create the context for them to reflect on themselves and, you know, reflect on their values, reflect on their beliefs, reflect on their ethics, Francis Rix's stuff, and how does that influence their lens? So really trying to create spaces to for people to come to their own understanding, I think that really that's our job.
Yeah, I certainly would not disagree with you. As we move towards ending this conversation, those child and youth care practitioners who believe in anti-oppression perspective, who are operating or trying to operate from anti-oppression perspective and are dealing with oppressive practices in their places of employment, are seeing, it could be sexism, it could be racism, it could be any number of other issues. How can the individual who is, you know, working, as we all know, for not huge wages in this field, who needs that job to maintain their own health and employment and to eat, how can an individual working within very clear structures that they view as oppressive challenge that oppression as an individual?
It takes a lot of courage to stand up to oppression. It takes a lot of courage to stand up and call out something that may be perceived as racist or sexist, as you said, or homophobic. I think it's important for us to have that voice. We're meant to be the voice for the youth that we work with, and so we have to maintain that within our setting, and we want to teach our young people to find their voice, and this is our opportunity to do that. Having said that, the risk is really, it can be quite high for a young person just coming into the field to want to stand up to the structure that's actually paying their wages. One of the things that we're doing at my organization, and it might be a little bit different than just a new graduate coming into the field, is we're really looking at trying to create a cultural shift. And you want to do that in the most respectful and helpful sort of way. It's that consciousness raising that is at a larger scale, because it is about your work culture and it is about your organizational culture. There's things that are inherently oppressive about child welfare that we would have a really hard time changing. That's going to change, but it's going to take a very long time. But there's things we can do within the four walls of this organization, and that's really just education and awareness. We have a committee, an anti-oppression committee, that meets regularly and then does creates educational opportunities for all the staff to participate in, to try to just move everyone along this path with the recognition that we're not all at the same place at that same time. And it's meant to be respectful. You know, at the same time that you're going to call somebody out in the coffee room because they've just made an off-color remark that is offensive and oppressive, you're going to do that awareness raising as well.
And if I can just add quickly to that, the other thing I think is important from an academic point of view in terms of teaching child and youth care students to operationalize this way of really being in the world, it's important to not only help students connect to that place in themselves where they can muster the courage to use their voice, it's also important to teach them the skills. And I think advocacy is a difficult skill to acquire, if you really want to be heard. I mean, we can all stand up and shake our fists, right? And very rarely does that make a difference, although sometimes it does. And I think in some cases there is, it's good to be angry. But I would say, generally speaking, you know, working on skill development in terms of advocacy is really important, and giving students opportunities to practice those skills with some really concrete feedback is also really important.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank both of you for bringing awareness of the importance of this work. And through people like yourselves, you know, as I said in the introduction, the new child and youth worker vocational standards embed the idea of advocacy and anti-oppression awareness and anti-oppression perspective in the requirements of a student to graduate into working in this field. And I think it's because people like you have put it out there and said, this is crucial, fundamental to the work that we do. So I want to thank you for all the work you've done over the years. And of course, thank you for the conversation that we've had today. I think there's a lot of stuff to think about, and I suspect this is a topic that I will discuss several more times over the coming episodes. So thank you very, very much, Rebecca and Wanda.
You're welcome. It was great fun.
This concludes this month's episode of C2Y Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher and visit us at c2ypodcast.org.